thing is that you're not going to totally get rid of the side effects with respect to the changes. So in the case of the amitriptyline, we have side effects that are due to these other mechanisms, blocking the alpha receptors, and blocking the estrogen receptors, and blocking the histamine receptors, and affecting the reacting the norepinephrine. So these are all more common with the amitriptyline than they are with the SSRI compound. The ones that are on the bottom are due to the increase in the components, so they're more common with the SSRI than they are with the tricyclic. So the sexual dysfunction, the insomnia, diarrhea, nausea, this slide shows that we have a relatively flat force response curve. So it's looking at sertraline, and it's true of the other compounds too. So when you're increasing the dose here, you get up to a point where you've got about 80% of the pumps inhibited. Then after that point, increasing the dose isn't going to increase the effectiveness that much. But it can be important as far as increasing the side effects. So when you increase the dose, you have to be able to, if you look at what's happening here, you're going from about 80, you know, getting up maybe close to 90, you haven't changed it that much. So this is the inhibition of the reuptake of the serotonin. This is the drug level. You get to reduce the side effects of the compound without necessarily increasing the therapeutic effect. Enzymes involved, if you use them before. Compounds do differ as far as drug interactions from enzyme inhibition. So that can be important when people are receiving other compounds. When you look at the compounds, the citalopram or the S-citalopram, probably the ones that cause a loose problem with inhibition of cytochrome P450s. The other compounds kind of differ in terms of their spectrum. This is a schematic to kind of show what's happened. This was the initial idea that the SSRI compounds were totally selective and all we did was block the reuptake of serotonin, and so we wouldn't see a lot of side effects and compounds wouldn't differ that much from one another. This is what's happened in actual practice. Big interaction with a lot of other receptors or a lot of these different cytochrome P450 enzymes, and so they do differ from one another in their spectrums. So they're not all alike, and you have a sheet that kind of gives you the pros and cons of what they thought was best for, you know, pros and cons for the individual agents. And again, that's just a generalization, so it's not necessarily what's always followed, but just again, try and emphasize that they're not just identical, that each one is equal to the other one. When you compare the tricyclics and the SSRIs, neither one is totally effective in treating depression. Somewhere between 60 and 65% of the people receiving them will respond. You can remember that a lot of people respond to placebo, so really only about 25 or 30% that's due to the drug. People will differ as to what they respond to. And as far as what they're defining as a response, is a 50% reduction of the symptoms at 6 weeks. So again, some people, if they continue taking it, they respond at a later date. So it's not cut off and stop seeing what happens if the person takes it for 3 months or 6 months, as far as the effectiveness. The next compounds are compounds that are a little different in mechanism. First one we're looking at here, the venlafaxine, is classified as a serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. So it's kind of like the tricyclic compounds, except we don't have the interaction with all those other receptors like histamine and alpha and to inhibit the reuptake of amines. We're looking for an aromatic ring and then drop the resistance to nitrogen. And we can't always predict what kind of activity we're going to have. Compound is a little bit different in that it has an alcohol. A lot of compounds that are active in the CNS, you don't want them to be polar, so you don't have functional groups like alcohol. Metabolism of the compound is important. You can have N or OD alkylation. One that will be important is this OD alkylated metabolite. It's essentially similar in activity to the parent compound. And notice the difference in the half-life. It's like 10 hours versus 3 to 4 hours. So this compound's recently been marketed. Indicated that it turns around and inhibits both serotonin and norepinephrine. We use low doses, it's more selective for inhibiting serotonin. But as you increase the dose, you end up inhibiting both of them. The cytochrome P2D6 is important in this compound because this is the one where you can have a genetic difference in the enzyme. So if you don't have the enzyme, you're not going to form that active metabolite, and the drug won't be as effective. When the compound is discontinued, the dose should be tapered. That's usually a problem with compounds that are more short-acting compounds. And this is the active metabolite. Do I have this slide in there? Is it in there? Yeah. Yes. Okay. I think this one is just marked in the middle of the summer. So it was the major active metabolite of the methoxy. The advantage of the compound is it's already active. In other words, it's not going to come with another active metabolite. You don't have to worry about the metabolism by the cytochrome 2D6. So if you have somebody that's on an inhibitor that you're on, you don't have to worry about decreasing the formation of the active metabolite, or somebody doesn't have the activity of the enzyme in the first place. Person doesn't have a problem with the cytochrome P2D6, or they're not on an inhibitor, then it really isn't that much different than the venlafaxine. If you're inhibiting the enzyme, or a person doesn't have the enzyme, then they're definitely an advantage. Approval, once a day. You don't have to worry about titrating it. Again, I don't indicate it's got a longer half-life than the other compound. Shows the active metabolite of the triple methyl oxygen. As far as marketing the compound, part of it also may have to do with the patent protection of the amyloxin. When the compounds go off of patent, you've got generic compounds competing and lower price. So then you're metabolizing the compound that's unique, and so therefore you get patent protection for a longer period of time. So they're heavily advertising the compound to try to get people to switch. Duloxetine is another compound that inhibits both serotonin and norepinephrine. There's two different dosage forms. Cymbalta is the one that's advertised for depression, and the other one for the stress urinary. Compounds also used in the treatment of pain. At the beginning of the depression section, I showed you that the pathways for pain and for things like mood overlap, serotonin and norepinephrine. So a lot of the antidepressants can be used in people that have pain. We're usually not drugs in the first place, but we're looking at people with chronic pain and they're not responding to other compounds. Metabolism, again, is important, so if a person is on calls that inhibited, isn't recommended. Again, when you look at it, it's, here's your aromatic ring, proper distance to your basic nitrogen. Ripion is again a compound that's got two different trade names, one for depression and the other as a vape smoking sensation. And again, you don't want a person to be taking both of these because it's the same active component. This is the one that's unique in that it also targets dopamine. So the norepinephrine and dopamine are the main neurotransmitters. Compounds related to compounds used for appetite suppression, where you don't have the halogen on the molecule and it's got triethyl on the nitrogen. This compound has been more difficult to figure out the mechanism. It's not as potent or inhibitor of the reuptake of amines. They also cause some release of the norepinephrine, so the fact that it's not directly targeting the, it's a weak inhibitor, it releases it, and that effectively should get more of a compound present. Again, a little bit unusual in that you've got a ketone in the molecule, and you don't see too many compounds with ketones, so CNS activity. Does lower the seizure threshold, so it shouldn't be taken by people that are epileptics. Metabolism of the compound is important, but in this particular case, what we end up with is a mixture of compounds that have activity. So these are considered to be active metabolites. So in this case, it usually doesn't make as much difference. If you don't form one of the metabolites, you form the other metabolites. So in that effect, you still see the therapeutic effect. So you've got the compound where you draw. Oxidized and methyl on the nitrogen. That's on the isopropyl tetraethyl. That's on the nitrogen. Or these other two metabolites are formed by reducing the ketone. When you reduce the ketone, you create a chiral center. So you have the neutral and trio isomers. Is similar to the tricyclic compounds. So once in a while you see it included in the bones, but it's left accepted because the mechanism is different. Notice that this is an antagonist on some of the serotonin receptors, 2A, 2C, 3, and the presynaptic norepinephrine receptors. Binding chemistry, tetracyclic, we do have four rings here. Catalysis, as you might expect, you can take the methyl off the nitrogen and other oxidation, but these are not considered to be contributing to the therapeutic effect. Trozodone, again, is different in mechanism. So you can inhibit the reuptake of serotonin, but you also block the serotonin 2A receptors. And we're putting it into a chemical class, we've done it different ways. The triazolpyridine would refer to this part of the molecule. Or we can consider it a derivative of phenylpyrazine. Phenylpyrazine would be this part of the molecule. Compound is metabolized by cleaving. We're going to end up cleaving it here. We're going to put the metaphor of phenylpyrazine. So we're losing the side chain here. This is the part that we're looking at as a metabolite. Not used as commonly because it's a very sedating compound. been associated with hepatotoxicity, the depletion of glutathione. CPS question, we're looking at the molecule, we could do our basic, we could do our nitrogens. Thank you. other words, does this relate to a genetic predisposition to depression? So when we found that there was a difference in the transporters, that was one of the things that they were looking at. They're still in the process of sorting out whether that affects a person's predisposition to depression or not. But obviously, when we use that as a target, you know, we think that the target is different than the effect of the drug might be different, or could change in terms of how people respond to a particular agent. There's a couple of tables that indicate the mechanism of the compound and also the side effects. So when you look at them in terms of generalizations, chemical classes of compounds, mechanism of action of compounds, and the type of side effects, you can see how selective are they. And again, the main thing is like your tertiary tricyclic compounds interact with a lot of receptors. Most of the other compounds are more selective. I guess I haven't opened up the CPS program, not CPS, but Paris Connect, but I'll do that sometime today, so it'll be available for you. The next section is looking at the compounds that are used in the treatment of attention deficit, or they can also be used in further uses. The big one is the attention deficit. They estimate that could be anywhere from 8 to 12% of children have attention deficit. Others indicate that that's too high, and it's really only 3 to 5. In the past, they used to think that children would outgrow attention deficit, but what they have found that it persists into adulthood. The estimate maybe 12% of adults have attention deficit. What happens is, as children age, you usually see less of a problem with like the impulsive, you know, behavioral issues. So people think it's gone away. Things like the inattention don't disappear. You see the breakdown of the attention deficit. So you can have just the problem with the attention. You can have problems with the hyperactivity or combination. A lot of times girls haven't been diagnosed because they're more apt to fit into the inattentive type. And these are the criteria that they use, and to be diagnosed, we need to have 6 of these. And these are the ones for the hyperactivity. 6 of them. We look at attention deficit, they focused on dopamine, that it was not having enough dopamine available. There's different types of dopamine receptors, but usually what they focus on are the D2 type of receptors. Dopamine isn't the only neurotransmitter that we look at. One of the theories is reflecting catechols in general, so either epinephrine, norepinephrine, or dopamine. Others indicate just the norepinephrine and the dopamine. Again, these are involved in some of the slides from the introductory part of the depression. Dopamine and norepinephrine for alertness and focus, and so on, motivation. One of the problems when you start looking at neurotransmitters in the CNS is you've got all these different regions of the CNS, and they have different neurotransmitters and different concentrations, different receptors, and different in terms of how they interact with one another. So the dopamine receptors here, 1, 2, and 3, the norepinephrine ones, beta 1 and alpha 2. Compounds that are used as far as FDA approval, I don't know. Again, you won't change your mind. This is what most of you know as far as the alpha 2 agonist. This was approved by the FDA this summer. The had been used previously, but wasn't an approved use. Now it is an approved use. And as far as off-label, a lot of the antidepressants will be used if people don't respond to these other compounds, or if they have many side effects for the other compounds. We'll be looking at the amphetamine-type compounds and the methylphenidate-type compounds. What this is trying to show is the relationship to either dopamine or to norepinephrine. So here's the phenethylamine, that's a common structural feature. And we're going to have the phenethylamine in these other compounds as part of the structure. Cover the amphetamine compounds first. Think of these as CNS stimulants. Again, attention deficit is a big use of the compounds. Narcolepsy is another use. Narcolepsy is when people can't stay awake. Compounds have been used to reduce appetite. They used to be used for weight loss back in the 60s and that. The problem is they are effective as far as decreasing appetite and losing weight, but the problem is it's not like a long-term loss. If people discontinue taking them, they usually put the weight back on. And then you've got a problem with abuse potential with the compounds, so people increase the dose that they're taking. You can develop physical dependency, so if you try to discontinue them, you end up with symptoms. Development of tolerance means that you need a higher dose to produce the same effect. Compounds we'll be looking at have different mechanism of action than sometimes when you're reading references, it's kind of hard to figure out the differences and what the net effect is in a lot of the new articles. But this is kind of what I'm still not. We try and put the amphetamine ones together. We're going to release the norepinephrine. If you use higher doses, you also end up increasing dopamine. You can block the reuptake of norepinephrine, you get some dopamine. In the peripheral system, the compounds can also interact with the alpha and beta receptors if they have side effects to that. Ketamine does have isomers. The B isomer, the dextro isomer, which is one that's usually used as a CNS stimulant, has more of an effect on dopamine. The levo isomer, as well as the dextro isomer, the B and the L, both affect norepinephrine. So we form the L isomer, when we look at the monoamine oxidase inhibitor. Concentration usually is considered low enough that we see a lot of CNS stimulation as a result. So mechanism to release the neurotransmitters and to block the uptake, to increase the amount available to the receptors. This is showing that the blocking of the reuptake of dopamine. One of the things they also look at is that when you end up with a high concentration inside the presynaptic neuron here with the norepinephrine, that one of the things that can happen is you get a reverse transport. So it's not being released just from your vesicles, but you're also pulling it back out, because you can't take it up into these vesicles. Because the amphetamine can take it into the vesicles, so it's blocking the uptake of the norepinephrine. This comes out of the basic and clinical pharmacology, so additional mechanism. And you're net effect is you're increasing the amount that's available to the receptors. So the schematic shows the same thing as far as cell. You take the compound into the increasing that in the run, you know, it would be transported into the vesicles. So yeah, to the reverse transport. CPS question, looking at the effect of urine pH on excretion. There. It's not metabolized rapidly, so when we talked about the adrenergic system previously, if we had an alpha methyl, we considered that wasn't a substrate for monoamine oxidase. It doesn't mean that you don't have any at all. It's going to be slower. This goes through the general structure activity relationship for amphetamines. We can have the methyl group on the nitrogen. Will make it more lipid soluble. It increases activity. Primary amine is next. And then if we put bulkier groups on the nitrogen, we end up losing activity. So, like apples, or you don't see long chains on there, or you don't see the disubstituted compounds. Stereochemistry for the action is listed here. So it's the dextroisomer that has the more potent effect on the CNS when you look at the stimulating effect compared to the levoisomer. If we have a group longer than a methyl on the carbon next to the nitrogen, attention for those focuses of like an apple or anything bigger than that, essentially will be an actor. If it's a hydrogen, we also use potency because now it's more rapidly metabolized. On the beta carbon, we have an alcohol. It's less active, and that's what you might expect. It's going to be more polar, less than you get into the CNS. What's surprising is that if we have a ketone there, that's active. And generally, on the aromatic ring, we're not going to have substitution. Okay, metabolism, this is where the aromatic oxidase came into play, and so on. We can oxidize the molecule, alpha carbon, beta carbon, the amine, aromatic ring, so since we're getting around the molecule. We make polar groups in the molecule, they can be conjugated. If you lose the amino group, you've got two possibilities. One is you oxidize the carbon, the other is you oxidize the nitrogen first. But in both cases, you can end up losing the nitrogen. If you oxidize the aromatic ring in the para position, it's not a very common reaction, but you can get a compound that will release the norepinephrine and dopamine. Particularly, then also oxidize the beta position. They're not necessarily totally inactive. It shows the metabolism. So if you oxidize first on the alpha carbon, yes, what you end up with is a phenylacetone as a metabolite. So having that methyl group should totally prevent metabolism. And then this is the metabolism by oxidizing on the nitrogen first. And again, the net effect is you form the phenyl acid. So even though it wasn't a substrate for, you wouldn't expect it to be look at substrate from all the oxidants, it doesn't mean that you can't lose it that way from your molecule. There is a prodrug that's been marketed for a couple of years. They did this to add a lysine to the nitrogen. And initially when they did this, they were trying to get a compound that would have less abuse potential. This compound would be a prodrug. It can't produce its effect as long as the lysine is on there. If somebody tries to inject the compound, it's not going to readily get into the CNS to produce an effect. So you're not going to see a CNS stimulant effect from it. So it's not going to be rapidly converted to the metabolite. Doesn't mean it's not going to be converted to the metabolite. Never. It's just that it's slower. Compounds used orally, and the advantage is you're releasing the compound by hydrolyzing the lysine from it, so you get it more a long duration over the day. That's been the major advantage that's come out of it. Last longer than using the amphetamine compound itself. And they use the amphetamine compounds, they're usually looking at sustained release type of products, giving a longer duration, so you can use it once a day. And this one is built into the drug molecule. Just to show you the structure on it. Just has a lysine on the nitrogen. Methamphetamine has a methyl group on the nitrogen. That makes it more potent, it's more like a soluble, it's more into the CNS. Same problem, same effect as far as urine pH. But because it's more potent, you have more of an abuse potential with the compound. An example of a compound that's related, this one has a double group on the nitrogen, and then it's substituted on the aromatic ring. A compound that was the condiment part of marketing as a combination product. Acts as a serotonin releasing agent, and they had problems with cardiac damage, bowel damage. They considered that was due to the effect of the serotonin. compound as far as using it for attention deficit is the methylphenidate. Compound has two chiral centers, so we actually have four isomers. And it comes down to one isomer being the active one. And when you look at the Ritalin and the methylphenidate, that's a racemic mixture. And they recently marketed specifically the one active isomer, PX methylphenidate, propofol. And we've also recently marketed a patch. Rather than using oral, using transcranial as well. It shows the four isomers. The ones in the middle here are your Ritalin and similar products as a racemic mixture. And then this is the Hovalent, which is the one active isomer, the real isomer. What effect will we have on pH level on the duration of action of the methylphenidate? One of the things that's unusual is you can exchange change the ester. So we started out with the methyl ester. Which is formed the methyl ester. That would be an active compound. The metabolite that had the aromatic ring oxidized can block the reuptake of norepinephrine. So we mentioned the parent compound was more effective as far as blocking dopamine, didn't really affect the norepinephrine. It doesn't mean when the compound is used, you don't have any effect on norepinephrine. It can be affected by the metabolite. We're using the compounds together. Now, for most people, the compounds are effective, and most of them are targeting the dopamine. These compounds have abuse potential, so they are controlled substances. The effect on appetite can be a problem in children. So children have problems with weight loss, or so they can't gain weight because of the effect on the appetite. Some of them have problems with insomnia, can't sleep at night. And some of them have problems like when the effect of the drug goes off, you see the irritability and the moodiness. So they're okay in children, when they come home with the children at night, after most amounts of loss. This next compound is related to the antidepressants that we covered. Blocks the reuptake of norepinephrine, but instead of being approved as an antidepressant, this one's been approved for the treatment of attention deficit. Again, when you affect one neurotransmitter, it impacts on others, so you also end up affecting the dopamine, but it's kind of a linear process. Similar to the other reuptake inhibitors, can be metabolized. The metabolite does have activity, but it's usually not present at a high concentration. If you remove the methyl group, it's less active, but you have a higher concentration. It's effective in treating attention deficit to 55-60%. This one's been used like in adults. In some cases, they don't worry as much about abuse potential with the compound.